Today is Thursday, September 27th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, as one woman prepares to tell Congress she was sexually assaulted by the president's Supreme Court nominee, several more women make accusations.
They're going to have a big shot at speaking and making their case. And you know what? I could be persuaded also.
At the UN General Assembly, President Trump accusing China of interfering in the upcoming midterm elections in the U.S. Will the U.S. Deputy Attorney General overseeing the Russia investigation keep his job? He's set to meet with the president today. Also ahead, a blind Kurdish immigrant living in the U.S. making music to wash away the pain. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, President Donald Trump at a news conference Wednesday said he would withdraw his support for Judge Brett Kavanaugh, depending on the testimony in a high-profile Thursday Senate committee hearing into multiple accusations of sexual misconduct against the Supreme Court nominee.
They're going to have a big shot at speaking and making their case. And you know what? I could be persuaded also.
At a news conference in New York, the president also defended Kavanaugh.
He's one of the highest quality human beings. He's a tremendous man. He's a tremendous genius. He's a great intellect.
But earlier in the day, Trump called the accusations against Kavanaugh a Democratic con job. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell seemed to agree with the president.
By any normal standard of American justice, this is nowhere near enough to destroy someone's reputation or nullify their career.
Democratic Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, though, blasting the Republican efforts to dismiss the accusations.
Leader McConnell has called this entire issue a smear campaign cooked up by Democrats. That's a blatant falsehood that demeans the women who have courageously come forward. They came forward, not Democrats.
A third woman has accused Kavanaugh of aggressive sexual behavior in the 1980s. The nominee has vehemently denied all of the accusations ahead of the Senate hearing, where one of his accusers, Christine Blasey Ford, is scheduled to testify. Joining us now to discuss this more is Jennifer Lawless, a University of Virginia Commonwealth Professor of Political and Social Thought. Thank you for being with us, Professor. So what is your overall take on all that is happening here?
We're clearly still at a point in time where allegations, credible as they may be, from one woman doesn't seem to be enough. And it seems like when Christine Blasey Ford came out with very detailed allegations, it wasn't sufficient, so we were waiting for other women to come forward. And that's consistent with the dozens of women who had to accuse Harvey Weinstein before he was removed from his position of power. It's consistent with the dozens of women who had to accuse Bill Cosby before those allegations were taken seriously. And so in politics, we seem to be in the same place. The second take home is that we still seem to be at a place in our culture where women are placed on trial for making these allegations the same way as men are for being accused. And that's not the case for any other type of crime. For other crimes, when people say that something happened, we tend to believe them. Here, when women allege that some sort of sexual assault took place, we tend not to.
What do you say to the fact that people are innocent until proven guilty, and just because you can go and accuse someone of something doesn't mean they should be convicted until there is, you know, some sort of investigation?
What we're seeing here, though, is a reluctance to engage in that investigation. And so, you know, this is certainly not enough to simply accuse Brett Kavanaugh of these allegations. The FBI should be investigating, witnesses should be called, and there should then be a determination on the part of the United States Senate as to whether his character is sufficient to have a lifetime appointment on the United States Supreme Court. But we tend not to automatically assume that these allegations merit investigation, despite the fact that the women coming forward seem very credible and quite reasonable.
What about President Trump's comments when he said it just seems ridiculous that someone when they're 15 is now coming out with these sorts of, you know, comments 30 some years later?
Well, I'm not surprised by President Trump's take on this. First of all, he's been accused over the course of his career of various sexual improprieties. And so it seems like a knee-jerk reaction for him to defend Brett Kavanaugh, similar to the way that he's always defended himself, which is by belittling and dismissing these women. But on top of that, I think he's actually opening up a broader debate, which we're beginning to see, which is at what point should your childhood behavior or your adolescent behavior no longer be an impediment to your future career? And here, I think it's an open question. But we're also talking about an incredibly prestigious lifetime appointment. We're not talking about a traditional, typical job. And we're no longer only talking about these allegations. If it turns out that they are true, we're also talking about somebody who has explicitly lied about his conduct. And that becomes, in a lot of ways, almost as damning as the behavior he's alleged to have engaged in.
Politically speaking, what does it say that all of the members of the Senate Judiciary Committee are older men who apparently didn't even feel comfortable, even though they are well-accomplished lawyers in their own right, to ask the questions and are bringing in a seasoned female sex crime prosecutor to actually conduct the hearing?
Well, I don't know if the men thought that they weren't qualified or capable. I think that they believed that the optics would be very, very bad. The Republicans have six women in the Senate right now, but none of them serves on the committee. And so the fact that they feel like they have to hire an outside counsel to ask the questions, I think, underscores how unrepresentative the party is and how tone deaf it's been in potentially anticipating an event like this and thinking that it might be useful to have women in their party play an active role on the Judiciary Committee.
But, you know, you've got some senators that have already said they basically they will vote for this nominee, and they haven't even heard the testimony of Ms. Ford or for that matter, the other two that have come forward.
I think it highlights the stakes involved in this Supreme Court nominee, right? We're at a point in time right now where the Republicans are about to embark on a dream come true, which is a fundamental shift toward a conservative court. Any decision that had been 5-4 against the conservatives now has the potential to be 5-4 in their favor, and that includes things like overturning Roe versus Wade. So given that the stakes are so high, it's not that surprising that a lot of them are willing to say, I don't care what she has to say, I don't care what he did. We're talking about the fate of the court, and I'm going to cast a ballot for him. And, you know, I think that that also highlights that the hearing tomorrow, in a lot of ways, is not a serious endeavor.
And then you've got two women, Senators Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins, who are under a lot of pressure because they're pro-choice Republican women. And if they vote yes for Kavanaugh, is it basically saying that they don't believe the women?
Well, it's complicated. First of all, Susan Collins has said that she's confident that Kavanaugh would not overturn Roe versus Wade. I have no idea on what she bases her confidence, but she has tried to sort of take the reproductive rights component out of this decision. If they vote for him, I think they're going to be stuck between a rock and a hard place because they have to argue that they don't believe Brett Kavanaugh's defense, even though he's their party's nominee for the court. And they would have to, if they vote against him, argue that Christine Blasey Ford was more compelling. So, you know, it's a difficult position to be in, but frankly, it shouldn't only be those two female senators who are in that position. There are a lot of anti-choice Republicans who should also have a problem with a Supreme Court nominee who is accused of sexual assault and now who's accused of engaging in quite a few additional sexual improprieties. Again, that's not to say that he actually did it, but to stop short of demanding any sort of FBI investigation or to stop short of demanding that we slow down this process and find out what actually is going on, I think speaks volumes to the fact that the Republicans are not taking this seriously. And it's not just these two women who we should hold responsible here. We should be holding all of the Republicans accountable.
That's Jennifer Lawless, University of Virginia Commonwealth Professor of Political and Social Thought. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Melania Trump will visit four African countries. VOA's Greta Van Susteren testifies on the Rohingya crisis before the House panel. Barack Obama takes a swipe at President Trump over the environment. And a Russian officer is named in the Britain nerve agent poisoning. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. While in New York for the UN General Assembly, President Trump Wednesday said he wanted a two-state solution to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The Trump administration has in the past said it would support a two-state solution if both sides agreed. Trump, in a meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, also said he wanted to unveil the plan in the next 2 to 3 months.
I like two-state solution.
Yeah,
that's what I think. That's what I think works best. I don't even have to speak to anybody. That's my feeling.
Netanyahu has said any future Palestinian state must be demilitarized and must recognize Israel as the state of the Jewish people, conditions that Palestinians say show he's not sincere about peacemaking. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Michael Fishbach, history professor at Randolph-Macon College in Ashland, Virginia, what he makes of all these comments.
Well, with all due respect to the president of the United States, I think it's important to realize how often the man changes his mind, speaks with little detailed knowledge on matters. And so it's hard for me to judge exactly what that means. My first thought when I heard it was, which one of his aides told him to say this, and why did he agree to do it? Particularly noting that doing so in front of the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, would present a real challenge for Netanyahu, who since 2009 literally has avoided using the two words Palestinian state, especially speaking in Hebrew to a domestic audience. So I came away puzzled, but yet I don't think it references anything solid in terms of any guarantees to work towards such a state. Indeed, the Israeli Prime Minister later spoke to the press saying that he had presented a list of requests of the United States. President Trump had given all of them to him, and so clearly the Israeli Prime Minister was nonplussed by the remark, and I think really that says it all.
The president said that a two-state solution is apparently what works best for both sides. Is, in fact, a two-state solution the only viable option?
Regrettably, no. The really viable, at least in the short-term option, is what we see now, which is no state, no nothing. Frankly, Israel is by far the dominant partner between it and the Palestinians, and state of perpetual non-resolution in some ways fits in perfectly with the last 70 years in which there's been a non-resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Israel has signed peace treaties with two Arab states and has de facto kinds of relations with other Arab states. But as far as the Palestinians, there has been no effective resolution, and because of its military might and diplomatic support, Israel's been able to live with that situation. So the spirit of your question is there an alternative as far as something that a peace treaty would produce, such as, for instance, a one-state solution or something along that line? I think if we phrase the question in those terms, then no, the two-state solution is the only one that has some kind of modicum of support on both sides. But again, I'm sad to say that the other alternative to the creation of a Palestinian state alongside an Israeli state is just a further continuation of the status quo and with really no forward movement. So that, unfortunately, is the alternative. That's what we've been living with, and we likely will continue to live with it in the near future.
That's Michael Fishbach, history professor at Randolph-Macon College in Ashland, Virginia. Well, President Trump also Wednesday accused China of trying to meddle in the November 6th U.S. congressional election, saying Beijing did not want his Republican Party to do well because his tough approach on trade. Trump made no reference to suspected Russian meddling in the 2016 U.S. election and provided no evidence for his allegation about China, which Beijing immediately rejected during the same meeting.
We have evidence. It'll come out. Forward? Yeah, I can't tell you now, but it didn't come out of nowhere, that I can tell you.
The comments come as the U.S. and China are embroiled in a tariff battle sparked by Trump's accusations that China has long sought to steal U.S. intellectual property, limits access to its domestic market, and unfairly subsidizes state-owned companies. On Monday, a new round of U.S.-imposed duties on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods and a retaliatory set of tariffs imposed by Beijing on $60 billion worth of U.S. goods took effect. The U.S. has already imposed tariffs on $50 billion worth of Chinese goods, and China has in turn retaliated on an equal amount on U.S. goods. Well, joining us now to talk more about this standoff is Rand Corporation senior economist Howard Schatz. What exactly is happening here with all this?
The United States has instituted tariffs and filed a WTO case largely in response to findings from what's called a Section 301 investigation that the U.S. Trade Rep started on last year, completed in March, in which the U.S. Trade Representative found that China had been conducting its technology transfer policies in an unfair way in contravention to what the United States thought were globally agreed upon rules. The United States views China's practices as not only violations of agreements and not only unfair, but also as potentially damaging the economy of the United States. In response, the president asked his administration to do three things. One of them was to institute tariffs, to raise tariffs on Chinese goods. The second was to institute the WTO case. And the third was to create special restrictions on Chinese investment. Now, we ended up not doing that. We've been raising tariffs in now three rounds. The first was on about $34 billion worth of Chinese imports. The second was on about another $16 billion, so raising it to $50 billion. And the third was the most recent action on $200 billion. The Chinese retaliated each time in equal amounts the first two times, and then on the $60 billion the third time, so that now U.S. additional tariffs are on about $250 billion worth of Chinese imports, and China's additional tariffs are on about $110 billion worth of U.S. imports into China. The U.S. actions are designed to get China to change its policies.
I mean, it would appear that there's a deadlock. What are the goals here?
So the U.S. has mentioned several goals. One of them, and this is a focus of the president, is the bilateral deficit. U.S. exports of goods to China in 2017 were $130 billion, whereas U.S. imports of goods from China were $506 billion. So that's a pretty sizable trade deficit. Now, if we add in goods and services, the deficit is lower, but not that much lower. So one is to lower the bilateral deficit. The second is the United States wants changes in China's industrial policy. It wants it to stop subsidizing industries in the way it does. It wants it to substantially change its technology transfer policies, what the United States calls forced technology transfer. And it certainly wants China to stop stealing technology and intellectual property. The United States also wants better enforcement of intellectual property. And finally, the United States wants better market access for U.S. goods and U.S. services and for U.S. investors. So fewer investment and trade restrictions.
It would appear, though, that there really is a deadlock. And whatever the findings were from the U.S. about unfair trade policies from China, are the actions that the U.S. is taking and the subsequent retaliation, is this possibly going to backfire and hurt our economy and theirs?
U.S. actions and Chinese actions are going to hurt both economies, certainly in the short run, could hurt both economies in the long run. The United States is certainly hoping that it will also help the U.S. economy and that on balance it will help more than it will hurt. So how will it hurt? Well, first of all, it's going to raise costs for both economies, right? There's no question tariffs are an extra tax. They are largely paid by the consuming country. They could hurt profit margins in the exporting country. But on balance, they make things more expensive, and therefore everything is a bit less efficient. That's how they could hurt. That's how the immediate way that they could hurt. Over the long run, the big speculation is how will these U.S. policies actually affect China, and especially Chinese policies? It is doubtful that China will fundamentally change its underlying development strategy in response to these measures. So there's a particular plan that China put out in 2015, I believe, called Made in China 2025, which is its plan to advance technologically and dominate a number of manufacturing industries, and it plans to do that through subsidies and other measures. China is most likely not going to retreat from that. China is unlikely to change unless it gets really hurt. So how could China get hurt by this? There are a number of ways. The biggest way that is most speculative is whether these measures cause supply chains to leave China. So what does that mean? Right now, China is a hub of manufacturing. A lot of other countries make inputs, send them to China where they get finished or they get improved, or China puts its own inputs together with them, assembles final products, and then sells the goods either in China or to Europe or to the United States. If these tariffs last long enough, it could be that companies move their facilities out of China to other countries. Some of them are looking at doing this. It's not clear how easy it is to do that for a lot of them. And also China has certain advantages. It has a tremendous manufacturing ecosystem. So this will cause some companies to leave China, but the real question is how many. Another way it could affect China is if it does cause a slowdown in growth. The Chinese Communist Party, which is the same thing as the Chinese government, really is committed to maintaining growth, maintaining employment, and it is willing to lend money to increase debt to do so. And there's a lot of discussion that its debt levels are getting unsafely high. So if it sees an economic slowdown, it could do further stimulus for the economy. That could weaken it over the long term. It's not clear that current U.S. policies will push China to change in the way that the United States really wants it to.
That's also on Wednesday. President Trump blasted Canada for the slow pace of talks over NAFTA, saying he's so unhappy that he rejected Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's request for a one-on-one meeting. The remarks by Trump, who repeated a threat to impose tariffs on Canadian autos, knocked the Canadian dollar down to a one-week low against the U.S. greenback. President Trump also Wednesday said he'd prefer to keep Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein in his job after the New York Times reported that Rosenstein had suggested secretly taping or recording Trump and recruiting cabinet members to remove the president from office. Rosenstein currently oversees special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into the Russian interference into the 2016 presidential election.
My preference would be to keep him and to let him finish up. You know, I call it a witch hunt, and it is a witch hunt.
The White House on Monday announced Trump would meet with Rosenstein on Thursday after conflicting news reports that Rosenstein would leave his post soon.
I'm going to meet with him tomorrow. I may call Rod tonight or tomorrow and ask for a little bit of a delay to the meeting because I don't want to do anything that gets in the way of this very important Supreme Court pick. So I don't want it competing and hurting the decision, one way or the other decision.
Rosenstein is often the target of Trump's anger. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Listen every Saturday and Sunday when a panel of Washington-based journalists discuss the week's top domestic and international news stories on VOA's Issues in the News. Drawing on sources from the White House, Capitol Hill, and overseas, we bring you the inside story from Washington. That's Issues in the News every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, earlier this year, two artists in Leesburg, Virginia, founded an art space where they could work and teach other art lovers as well. Part retail business, part studio, Clay and Metal Loft helps aspiring local artists gain the skills and confidence needed to start their own business. But as Faiza El Masri tells us, the founders have a bigger dream. They want their space to energize the community. Faith Lapidus narrates.
Make that round, and then we're going to stick our thumb in.
In the clay hand-building class, ceramist Amy Manson shares some of her techniques with participants who come twice a week.
Today's project is hand sculpting, and sculpting through a pinch pot process, a pumpkin. So you're making two pinch pots, enclosing them to make a round orb, and then sculpting it to look like a pumpkin. The first time might be a little scary. They're not sure. They're a little intimidated on how hard to push or how the clay is going to react. But after one time, they get a little more confident. Once you've got the air trap, you can still sculpt and fix and do what you need to do.
Many of the students have a background in arts and want to hone their skills and learn different techniques. Barbara Johnson started doing pottery 3 years ago.
Having your hands in clay is just this calming kind of thing. And it's so creative because you may start out thinking you're going to make this piece, and it turns into something totally different.
Recently, Johnson has started selling her work.
I'm humbled a lot of times when someone says that they want to purchase, you know, my things and have them in their home.
Manson's partner, her friend Anne Andre, is a jeweler who creates transformative pieces, like a pendant that can also be worn as a ring.
5 years ago, really started looking to see where we could have this business model. And we thought, wouldn't it be great to do something that was more clay and jewelry making, because we didn't see anything like that before.
This is a perfect fit.
Andre teaches jewelry making classes.
They hammer the metal, they get an effect, you know, that they never thought they could do themselves. They form something like a bracelet, and it's just, they're excited. They think, I made this. And they go out wearing it, which is really nice.
That's how Jennifer Mettish feels when she wears the pendant she made.
I love turquoise. I'm a country girl, grew up around horses. Turquoise has always been just kind of a symbol of that rustic look.
Considering a second career beyond horses, she's finding a potential in jewelry making.
I feel that there has been such a revival of handmade items that people, they're more willing to pay for something that is made by a single artist than something that is mass-produced.
And then you can feel how much clay is in the bottom.
The founders of Clay and Metal Loft want to be part of that revival. Through summer camps, they want to inspire kids. And through their monthly Ladies' Night workshops, they try to help busy professionals unwind. Their goal is to become a creative, fun space for the entire community. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Whoa.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA, or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world.
Ah.
Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
Well, you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show. Thanks for being with us. Join us anytime at voanews.com. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.